Good afternoon. My name is Senesius, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Improving Heat Health Resilience Through Urban Infrastructure Planning and Design conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. If you should need any assistance during the call, please press star zero, and an operator will come back online to assist you. I'll now turn today's conference over to Ms. Victoria Ludwig from EPA. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining us today for our webcast, the second in a series focusing on the connection between climate change, heat islands, and public health. We will go for an hour and a half today, and before we begin, I'm going to ask Wendy Jagalam from ICF International to give us just a few quick logistic points.
Thanks, Victoria. So on your screen, you can see an image of the GoToWebinar panel. You can open and close the control panel using the arrow in the red box highlighted in the upper left. Note that audio is only available by telephone using the information on the slide. As noted by the operator, participants are on mute. However, we encourage you to please send in questions for the speakers using the GoToWebinar question pane. Simply enter your question into the box and hit send to submit your questions. And we ask that you do please indicate which speaker your question is intended for. That way we'll know where to direct your question during the question and answer session at the end of the webcast. Back to you, Victoria.
Thank you. As a quick reminder, this is, as I said, the second part of a two-part webcast series. In July, about a month ago, we had the first one. The idea of the series is to focus on this connection between the three things, but also to focus on two different aspects of that connection. The first one is what we talked about in the first webcast, which is the idea that communicating on the connection between climate change, heat islands, and public health is a great way to leverage public awareness of these issues. And also, if the public health industry as well as the environmental agencies work together on this communication, it's much more effective. The second one today is how to work in the long term to protect public health and protect heat health issues by working with urban design and infrastructure and the built environment. Solutions to cool the city is a way to protect people from heat health over the long term. The proceedings from the first webcast are ready and up on our website. You can see the URL at the bottom. In a couple of weeks, the proceedings from this webcast will be available at the same location. So today we have two great speakers. We're very happy to call this an international webcast. We have Pierre Gosselin from our friendly country to the north who will be speaking. Some of you may have noticed, if you signed up a couple of weeks before this, that we had Health Canada on the agenda. They unfortunately, because of the upcoming federal election, they were unable to speak after all. In addition, we have Jason Vargo from the University of Wisconsin, who is going to talk about research that he's done in this area. Then, as Wendy said, we will have a Q&A session at the end, about 20 minutes, if possible. And I'm going to start with an overview of what the heat island is, how it connects with public health, and how urban design can help with both of these issues. I am a program manager with the US EPA State and Local Climate and Energy Program, and I also manage within that program the Heat Island Reduction Program. So some of you may know a heat island is an area of warmer temperature in the urban core. The temperatures are often warmer at both the surface and air level, in some cases, warmer than the surrounding areas. It's important to remember that a heat island can occur in a big city and in a small city and even in the suburbs. The exact dynamics of the heat island vary according to climate, demographics, and the way the urban area is designed. But the principle is the same. And the causes are often the same. The top photograph, you can see that the impermeable surfaces, the way that urban areas often have canyons, the lack of vegetation causes dry materials that store energy, and therefore it makes the surrounding area warmer. Waste heat from cars and from air conditioning units and other mechanical items does also contribute to the heat island. If, however, you have you have permeable surfaces, you have vegetation, you're going to have less heat storage, more evapotranspiration, which cools the air through moisture. You're going to have shade. You're going to have things that contribute to a lower temperature. How does climate change impact the heat island effect? The climate change contributes to higher temperatures, as we know. And so in our recent report that EPA did called Climate Indicators in the U.S., our 2014 edition, we found that currently there are more unusually hot summer days happening in the last few decades. More importantly for the heat island is that we have more unusually hot summer nights. And this is a key aspect of the heat island, is that often the temperature difference between the urban area and the surrounding areas is higher at night. And so therefore, people do not have an opportunity to cool down, and that contributes to serious health issues. And these data are backing that up, as you can see. In the future, climate models from the U.S. and from international communities are projecting that we can increase in not just the frequency or the intensity of heat waves, but also the duration. So all three things there. And in addition, so you have higher temperatures, you have increased heat waves, and then the heat island effect inside an urban area exacerbates the intensity of a heat wave. So these things are very important as far as how they contribute to each other. What does extreme heat mean for public health? It's a very serious issue. In addition to asthma and other respiratory problems, people can get heat cramps, heat exhaustion, heat stroke, but also heat-related mortality does happen. And what we found is that the National Weather Service has tracked that extreme heat is often the most deadly weather-related event in a given year. In some years, it's the most deadly weather-related event, more than hurricanes, more than earthquakes. So it's quite serious, and we're all familiar with the heat wave in Chicago and heat waves in Europe. And again, we found at EPA that nearly 8,000 Americans have suffered death from, have died from heat-related illnesses since 1979. That peaked in 2006, which was the second hottest year on record so far. In the bubble on the right, you can see a quote from, we had someone who worked on the Yale project in our first webinar, who really focused on the fact that a few Americans really realize how serious heat issues can be and how those are related to climate change and the heat island effect. So when they do understand that link, they are more inclined to act on it, but they really don't make that link right now. Hence, the importance of the public health fields and the environmental fields, the importance of them working together on this issue. Obviously, there are certain types of people that are more vulnerable to the heat health illnesses. Older adults, children, people in lower income stratas, folks who work outdoors, and people with compromised health, both physical and mental. Also, there's air quality issues that come from the high temperatures contribute to more ozone. Ozone contributes to asthma. So not just heat stroke and other things, but chronic air quality illnesses. I'm focusing on older adults because we have a program at EPA focusing on aging. So we have some stats that show that older adults account for the majority of deaths from extreme heat events. In 2014, for example, the number of deaths that we had, 85% of those folks were over age 65. Obviously, with baby boomers, the population of older adults is growing, and 81% of older Americans live in metropolitan areas. So as temperature increases, as climate change gets worse, this group is just going to have more susceptibility to problems. But not to give a bunch of depressing stats, we do have solutions, and a lot is going on in the U.S. related to this. Short term, as we know, there are things that public health agencies are doing, cooling centers, making people aware of the risks of heat. But long term, working with urban planners, sustainability directors, public health officials, working together on cooling down the built environment is a great way to cool cities and then prevent some of the negative effects that are going to come from future climate change and temperature increases. Specifically, these are the five most common measures for reducing the heat island effect. Trees and vegetation, which tends to be the most popular measure that U.S. cities have taken. In addition, all of these things give health benefits, but they also have co-benefits for improving air quality, reducing energy use, reducing greenhouse gases, and saving money on electricity. But trees do a little more. They have carbon storage benefits. Green roofs are popular now for reducing stormwater runoff and cooling the stormwater. And they obviously sometimes are used for urban agriculture and multiple other benefits. Cool roofs help to save energy. They cool the building. They cool the surrounding air. And as a consequence, it makes for more reliable energy supply, which during a heat wave is really crucial. You don't want to lose power because that will affect air conditioning. Cool pavements, which are permeable, are a way to lower the air temperatures in the around the pavements. Also, it has been shown to have public safety benefits in terms of improving traction of cars and improving nighttime driving visibility. And smart growth, which is the idea of having mixed uses in a compact area, promoting things like walkability and low impact development, they usually come with more vegetation, less paved areas, et cetera, and that reduces the temperature in those areas as well. So quickly, I'm going to talk about some resources that we have at EPA. As I mentioned, we have a Heat Island program, which is part of our local climate and energy program. And we work with a variety of stakeholders, mainly local governments, but also state governments and nonprofit organizations and trade groups to increase awareness of the heat island effect and increase understanding of programs and policies that can reduce the temperature in a city and can do that cost effectively and also bring multiple benefits. We have some of the standard resources, a great website, which we're in the process of updating, newsletter. We have, this is one of the examples of a webcast that we do. We have a database of information on what is happening in the U.S. Around this issue. Our key resources are Heat Island Compendium, which goes into very good detail about each of the mitigation strategies that I talked about. It has more information on what's going on in the U.S. and also explains the scientific basis behind the causes and the impacts of the heat island effect. Also, quickly I'll mention that the Local Climate and Energy Program has also a lot of great resources to not just heat island measures, but programs that work around sustainability and climate change mitigation and adaptation. So I would encourage you to check out the website. Some of these go to the issue of how to implement programs, how to avoid common obstacles, how to design a program in a model way. So I think no matter what you're doing in your area, these will be very useful, heat island or not. So there's my contact information, the websites, and also I would encourage you to sign up for the Heat Island newsletter as well as the state and local climate and energy newsletter. And there's the URL. We will be posting all these presentations, so you can have reference to that later. Thank you very much.
Great. So before we move on to our next speaker, we wanted to ask a quick poll question of everyone in the audience. So on your screen, you should see the first poll question, which is, why is your community interested in reducing the heat island effect? And we ask that you choose up to two of the options. Are you interested in reducing the heat island effect to improve public health, to reduce greenhouse gases, to save energy, to adapt to the impacts of climate change, or to improve overall community livability? So we'll give everybody just a few seconds to select their responses. Again, we ask you to select up to two of the options. I'm going to give everyone just a few more seconds. Great, I'm going to go ahead and share the results of this poll. So it looks like 63% are interested in improving public health, which is appropriate for today's webinar. 57% are interested in adapting to the impacts of climate change, 53% in improving overall community livability, 23% in reducing greenhouse gases. So thank you very much for participating in this poll question. We'll do a couple more later in the webcast. And I just wanted to remind everyone to please send in your questions for Victoria and the other speakers using the GoToWebinar question pane, and please indicate which speaker your question is for. And with that, back to you, Victoria.
Thanks, Wendy. Thanks for answering the poll questions again. Those are useful to us for helping us understand which resources are best and what our stakeholders need.